So this morning we're going to consider the 10th sutta in the Bodhi section, the Bodhi tree section of the Udana. This is the Bahya Sutta, which we had read to us last night in the puja. And the Bahya Sutta takes place many years after the Buddha's enlightenment, probably quite a long time afterwards actually. The setting of the sutta is Anathapindika's monastery, although monastery is actually misleading. The word is Arama, which means a pleasure ground, a pleasure park. It would have been a beautiful park, which Anathapindika, the very wealthy lay disciple of the Buddha, had donated to the Buddha and his full-time wandering disciples. He just donated this great big park, beautiful park, to the Buddha and his disciples. There would have been some grass, maybe even some wooden huts, but it certainly wasn't a monastery as we understand it. And the Buddha was staying in part of the park known as the Jetta Grove, the bit of the park donated by Prince Jetta. And this grove and park are situated on the outskirts of the great city of Shravasti, in northern India. So it's important to note that the Buddha, after his enlightenment, often stayed near to the great cities of northern India. He stayed near to people in order to teach them the Dharma. So this is how the sutta opens. At the same time, at a place called Suparaka, there lives on the seashore, on the beach, someone by the name of Bahya of the bark cloth. And the text says that he was respected, revered, honoured, venerated, and given homage, and was one who obtained the requisites of robes, alms food, lodging, and medicines. So Bahya is some kind of homeless wanderer, some kind of holy man. He's living a full-time spiritual life. It seems not part of any particular community. He's a sort of freelance wanderer. And he's got a bit of a following. People have a bit of faith in him. What's also interesting here is where Bahya is staying. He's on the seashore at Suparaka. Suparaka was a very, very long way from Shravasti. Shravasti is in northern India, in present-day Uttar Pradesh, or its remains are in present-day Uttar Pradesh, not far from Lucknow, kind of over to the northeast of India. Suparaka is on the west coast of India, identified these days as an area near Bombay. And in those days, Suparaka was a thriving port city. But it's a very long way from the region in which the Buddha was teaching, over 1,000 miles away. And Bhante wonders, in fact, if Bahya was even from what we now call India. There wasn't a country, of course, called India in those days. There were many different countries. But Bhante wonders if Bahya's bark cloth indicates that he was someone who wore a robe, clothing, made from the fibre extracted from a particular kind of tree, which apparently was well known in the Middle East, clothing made out of such fibre. And the fact that he was staying at Suparaka, which was well known for its trading links with the Middle East, he even wonders if the name Bahya means something like foreigner. So he wonders, and it's speculation of course, but he wonders if Bahya is a holy man of some kind who's from the Middle East, who somehow has ended up living on the beach in Western India. It's an interesting speculation and perhaps a bit of a challenge to any idea that the Buddha's teaching is only for certain people from certain countries and cultures and not for others. Whatever, Bahya is doing well, it seems. And one day while meditating, while he's in seclusion, in retreat, he wonders if he has attained enlightenment. The text says he wonders if he's an arahant, or if he's on the path to arahantship. That's how the text puts it. But we have to remember that Bahya would not have been thinking using any Buddhist categories. He would have been using whatever concepts he was familiar with to describe substantial spiritual attainment, realization, insight, wisdom, God realization, whatever. That's what he's wondering. And sometimes people do that. They have some kind of experience, perhaps meditating or through meditation or in some other way, and they wonder, am I a stream entrant? Am I enlightened? Am I Jesus Christ? I am Jesus Christ. I am the Buddha. This does happen. It can even become something of an obsession. They want to know where they stand, what level they are at, what kind, they want that kind of certainty. Perhaps it's, you know, they want to have a feeling that I'm saved, you know, life is fine, I'm saved, I've made it. And this gets particularly dangerous if you've got a bit of a following. If you've got a bit of charisma and a bit of following, you can get into a very dangerous situation for yourself and others. We've seen it many, many times in our own movement. Fortunately for Bahia, he got him told immediately where he was actually at. The text says that a devata, a god, who was formerly related to Bahia, told him straight out that he was not an arahant, and he was not even on the path to arahantship. Not only that, he told Bahia that he didn't even follow a practice that could even possibly lead to arahantship. And the text says this devata said all this out of compassion for Bahia, wishing to benefit him. So traditionally, Buddhists would take this literally. Gods, devas, appear to people and can give them advice. But even the tradition would say that an encounter with a god can only come about if you yourself are in a very positive state, a very positive meditative state. The realms of the gods, of the devas, who of course aren't enlightened in any way, but they're said to correspond to the higher states of consciousness that we call the dhyanas, the jhanas in Pali. Bahia was perhaps someone who could get somewhere in meditation, could dwell in dhyana. Perhaps that's why he wondered if he was enlightened, because in some states of dhyana you can sort of feel that self and other are sort of dissolving. That's why they're so pleasurable, but it's very easy to think that you've somehow realized some substantial insight. But thankfully there was an intelligence, even a wisdom present as well, that didn't allow him to delude himself, that revealed that he was not on the path to enlightenment and that his practice would not even lead to enlightenment. Bahia was in a way protected by higher states of consciousness, by a friendly God, however way you want to conceive that. He had, if you like, a spiritual friend who could point out where he was really at. The vast majority of us, of course, need ordinary, human, spiritual friends to show us where we really are. We need people to wake us up out of our self-delusion. Bahia asks the devata, he doesn't just sort of back down and say, oh no, I'm not, am I? But he asked the devata, well, who are the arahants? Who are the enlightened ones? And where can they be found? And the devata tells him about the Buddha living in the far off districts, the distant country of Shravasti, and that he teaches Dhamma for the realization of arahantship. This might sound strange to us, but if you're serious about meditation, if you have a more flexible consciousness, you do get intuitions about who you need to find and what you need to do. And Bahia's response to the devata is very strong indeed. The text says that Bahia of the bark cloth was profoundly stirred by the words of the devata. Profoundly Stirred is a translation of a very wonderful Pali Sanskrit word, Sangvega. Sangvega, which is a very, very strong word indeed. It means you're deeply, profoundly moved and stirred. It has a kind of connotation of both being thrilled and humbled. It's that kind of quality to it. He's just deeply stirred at hearing about the Buddha, at hearing perhaps that he's not enlightened. So he's deeply stirred, thrilled, humbled by the mention of the Buddha teaching the Dhamma for arahantship. It's very important, I think, to recall those times, those moments, perhaps those early encounters with the Dhamma when we have been stirred, moved, thrilled, humbled at the Buddha and the Dhamma, by the beyond, if you like. Bahia is so stirred, so moved, that he just took off. Just there and then, he just left Suparaka, left the seashore, left the west coast, left his well-supported situation, left to his followers, just gave it all up and just started to walk to Shravasti. He didn't even think how far it was. He just went. The text says that he just stopped each night, but he just kept walking throughout the day. He was so energized at the prospect of finding this man called the Buddha, who taught this thing called Dhamma for the full realization of arahantship. And when I think of Bahia's circumstances, when I think of Bahia walking like that, I can't but help think of Bhante in India, living the life of a freelance, wandering ascetic, mainly in South India, with the name Dharmapriya, the lover of the Dharma, which he gave himself, a lone Buddhist amidst Hindus, but with a strong inner vision and conviction about the Dhamma, with a strong individual connection with the Dhamma. In fact, the Buddhist he met, he didn't find that impressive. He felt very alone with the Dhamma, but it made him all the more determined to fully and formally commit himself to the Dharma. He had that vision in the Virupaksha Guha in South India, next to Ramana Maharshi's ashram of Amitabha, holding up the lotus flower, the Amitabha, within the heart of the big Amitabha up there, as a sort of, and he took that as a sort of sign that he needed to commit himself formally to the Dharma by getting ordained. And he went to Sarnath to seek ordination, but he was turned down for ordination, he and his friend, turned away. And then the two of them had to walk hundreds of miles at night, because it was the height of the hot season, walking along the railway line to Kushinagar. And of course his friend, just to say, although he was with a friend, his friend, when they were turned down for ordination, got really, really angry and wanted to reject Buddhism altogether and become a follower of join the Ramakrishna mission. And Bhante had to persuade him, no, let's go for refuge. So although he was with somebody, in a sense he was alone. And they walked along the railway line at night to find Uchandramani and to seek ordination with him, which was given. Like Bahia with young Sangharakshita, there is this, or Dharmapriya as he was called, there is this intense individual determination. So we need to reflect on this, all of us. But particularly if you've asked for ordination. Board of members too, but particularly if you've asked for ordination. We've set up these going for refuge retreats. Locally, order members provide all sorts of classes and study groups. There's all sorts of things available. There's a lot of spiritual friendship available. So many things available. But the question is, how hungry are you for the Dharma? How thirsty are you for the Dharma? How motivated are you? Have you really been touched and stirred and moved and shaken by the Dharma so that you as an individual will really give yourself to the training? We need, all of us need, to remember the two aspects of the ordination ceremony, the private ordination aspect and the public ordination aspect of the ceremony. In the private ordination, you go alone to your private preceptor. You step out alone. You go alone. And Bhante was always very clear about the symbolism of this, and I think it comes from his own actual experience, this symbolism. You are willing and able to go for refuge, even if nobody else is going for refuge. You're willing to do whatever it takes, even if everybody else is against you, to go for refuge. And your private preceptor is the man who you respect, even revere, who individually witnesses this in you, who sees this and knows this directly, that you are willing and able to go for refuge alone, if necessary. Sometimes people wonder why they're not ordained, why they're not ready. They might have been around for a long time. And you sometimes hear them complaining, well, there's something wrong with the order members, something wrong with the order, something wrong with the movement. Very often, it's because they themselves are not serious enough. They're not hungry and thirsty enough for Dharma. They're either passive and or grabby. They're not individually deeply moved and stirred and shaken by the Dharma. That's my experience. If they were, if they had that hunger and that thirst, they wouldn't, in a sense, worry about being ordained. They'd be confident that the truth will come out. The truth will be revealed. So it's very important to check repeatedly how individual is your engagement with the Dharma. So there's very great importance placed here on solitary retreats. Bhante has said that every order member should do a 1 month solitary retreat every year. I think that's observed more in the breach than in the actuality. But the principle still stands. And you need to do solitaries. I think it's good to do solitaries before you're ordained. Of going away alone to meditate, to study, to reflect, to be with yourself, to sit and do nothing without the mobile and without the laptop, definitely not with the television, just with you and your life and your actual situation. Anyway, Bhāhya goes to Shravati. He finds an Artapindika's park. He finds the Jeta Grove and he asks the bhikkhus there where the Buddha is. And they tell him that the Buddha is out in the city of Shravasti begging his one meal of the day. This indicates, by the way, that it's sometime in the morning. It's because the Buddha always went out early morning for the begging while the people were cooking. So Bhāhya went straight off to Shravasti. He went hurriedly, the text says, to find the Buddha. And the text describes how Bhāhya saw the Buddha. He saw the Lord walking for alms food in Sarvati, pleasing, lovely to see, with calmed senses and tranquil mind, attained to perfect poise and calm, controlled, a perfected one, watchful, with restrained senses. John Ireland actually has left out a word here used to describe the Buddha, and that word is naga, which here means elephant. I don't know why he's left it out, perhaps for cultural reasons, or he's sort of interpreted it as perfected one, something like that. But in India, of course, the elephant is a very important symbol indeed, especially the bull elephant, the king of the herd, the great Tusker. And the Buddha and the enlightened ones are often likened to such elephants. And elephants are incredibly beautiful, stately creatures. They are massive, towering and powerful, of immense strength, and yet they walk with such grace and poise and purpose. And of course, they're ancient symbols of wisdom. And the bull elephant, of course, are the leaders of the herd. And I must say, I looked up the Pali and I wondered if, in fact, John Ireland really gives the full force of what the Buddha looked like to Bahia, how he appeared to Bahia. Remember, Bahia is a man who was deeply stirred and thrilled at simply hearing the Deva referring to the Buddha. He's really in touch with a deep urgency and, this samvega. So here's an alternative translation. He saw the richly endowed one wandering for alms food in Sarvati. Bright and pleasing he was, beautiful to see, with peaceful senses and peaceful mind, in full attainment of composure through mastery, like a tamed, watchful, perfectly trained elephant. Might sound a bit strange to us, but what is being communicated here is a vision of the Buddha, the actual state of the Buddha, which Bahia can see, can intuit, because of his own spiritual arousal. The Buddha is bright and pleasing and beautiful. He's lovely. His very appearance inspires confidence and faith. The word which I've translated as bright, which could also be clear or pleasing, is pasada, which is a word for faith and confidence. So it's not just that the Buddha is pleasing to see. He's actually, when you see him, your faith, your pasada, your confidence is aroused, is awakened. You're sort of blessed by that presence. And Bahia can see how peaceful the Buddha is, not just externally. He sees his peaceful senses. There's no distraction there. The Buddha's eyes aren't wandering about. They're very, very calm and peaceful, his senses, just looking straight ahead. But Bahia also intuits the Buddha's deeply peaceful mind. But he's also aware of the Buddha's tremendous presence, his watchfulness. Watchfulness. There's this bright, watchful awareness. Then there's his poise, his grace, perhaps, his energy, his spiritual strength. He really is like a great bull elephant. All that strength and energy and wisdom is there, and it's mastered. It's not out of control. So the Buddha's appearance is sublime, faith-inspiring. So this is the vision of the Buddha that Bahia has. The vision, even you could say, of what mindfulness really looks like. So it's very important, I think, to dwell on this passage, especially in the light of the teaching that the Buddha gives to Bahia later on. We'll look at that a bit later. A teaching that I think is frequently taken out of its context, out of the context of Bahia's spiritual arousal and commitment, out of the context of his vision, his real seeing of the Buddha, his Buddha darshan. I also want to relate this vision of the Buddha to the private ordination ceremony. In that ceremony, as part of your individual commitment to the three jewels, as part of the going for refuge, you will formally commit yourself to a particular meditation practice. A meditation practice connected to the vision of the Buddha, of enlightenment, of self-transcendence, of the beyond, that really speaks to you, that thrills you, that moves you, that is pleasing and attractive and beautiful to you, that spiritually arouses you. This could be, of course, the Buddha himself, or it could be one of the archetypal forms that have arisen over the centuries in Buddhist tradition. It might even be something else. But the point is here that if we're to make real spiritual progress, we need to engage our deepest drives, desires and energies. So we need an image, a form, a something that communicates the beyond, enlightenment, as fully and as attractively as possible, that really touches us, that really stirs us and moves us. And after ordination, we meditate on that form, on that image, that something, that Buddha, as much as we can. For it's the image of us fully and completely spiritually reborn. Without this dimension in our spiritual life, we so easily fall back into a sort of self-referential, psychological notion of the Dharma life. And when I say meditate on an image like this, I don't just mean doing that, you know, in a formal meditation. I mean living from and for that vision in everything we do. The Buddha's vision of Bahya is the vivid, living expression of enlightenment, of liberation. That's what Bahya is seeing, which stirs him and moves him profoundly. And we need to find a vision of the vivid, living expression of enlightenment in our lives now. And we do that through activating our faith, our devotion, and our imagination. But let's go back to Bahya. Having really seen the Buddha, Bahya immediately falls at the Buddha's feet. He immediately falls at the Buddha's feet. There is an immediate expression of faith and devotion, an immediate expression of commitment to the Buddha. You could even say that in this act of just falling at the Buddha's feet, Bahya is going for refuge to the Buddha. In placing his head at the Buddha's feet, Bahya is showing indeed, in action, that he regards the Buddha as his teacher and he regards the Buddha as his refuge. He's also displaying his receptivity to the Buddha and his surrender to the Buddha. And Bahya says, "Teach the Dhamma, Lord. Teach me Dhamma, Lord." The traditional word for Dhamma teaching that Bahya uses is Dhamma Desana, which could be translated more literally as "Show me the Dhamma, Lord. Point out the Dhamma, Lord. Reveal the Dhamma, Lord. Reveal the truth. Reveal reality. Teach me Dhamma, Lord. Teach me Dhamma Sugata, so that it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." But the Buddha tells Bahya that it's not the suitable time for him to communicate the Dhamma. It was the Buddha's custom not to teach while begging his food, not to do any other thing while he was begging his food. That was all done in silence. The Buddha preferred to do one thing at a time. I don't think you could ever imagine the Buddha multitasking. He does one thing at a time with full single-minded mindfulness and concentration. But Bahya felt a tremendous sense of urgency. So he asked again for the Buddha to show the Dhamma, adding, "It's difficult to know for certain, Bhante, how long the Lord will live, or how long I will live. Show me the Dhamma, Lord. Teach me the Dhamma, Sugata, so that it will be for my good and happiness for a long time." And again the Buddha declined. And again Bahya entreated with those same words. We have here, of course, is real entreaty and supplication. This is the mood that we need to generate in that part of the puja. If we're to receive the Dhamma, there needs to be a real vision of the Buddha, a real devotion to the Buddha, a surrender to the Buddha, and a keen awareness of the preciousness and transitoriness of life. And a real desire to learn the Dhamma, to see the Dhamma. If we're in that state, then the Dhamma really goes in, goes straight to the heart. And there doesn't need to be so many words for the Dhamma to be shown and seen. And the Buddha, of course, sees that Bahya is serious. And he's so moved by this, I guess, he breaks his custom. It's quite a big thing for the Buddha to break his custom. He doesn't do that superficially. And after the third entreaty, the Buddha immediately shows the Dhamma in its fullness in just a few simple words. He tells Bahia what he really needs to know. I'm using a bit of a different translation. The Buddha says, Bahia, you should train yourself like this. In the seen, there must be only the seen. In the heard, there must be only the heard. In the thought, there must be only the thought. In the perceived, there must be only the perceived. When, Bahia, for you, in the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the thought, only the thought. In the perceived, only the perceived. Then, Bahia, you will have no thereby. When you have no thereby, you will have no therein. As you, Bahia, have no therein, then there is neither here, nor beyond, nor in between the two. Just this is the end of all suffering. So this showing of the Dhamma, this revelation of Dhamma, went right into Bahia, because the sutta tells us that Bahia, on hearing it, was immediately liberated from all grasping, from the deep, deep grasping to conditioned existence, and from all the asavas, the deep inner floods, the drives that keep us bound up with the wheel of life, with conditioned being and existence. It's as if Bahia was one with the Buddha's words. He trained as the Buddha spoke. As the Buddha communicated, Bahia was training. As soon as the Buddha spoke the training, Bahia was training. And that severed all the bonds. He was liberated. He became an arahant, an enlightened one. We might hear that very simple, very direct Dhamma showing, but it doesn't result in liberation. Well, obviously, that's because the Buddha is not vividly present before us in all his majesty and glory. And it's because we don't have the faith, the devotion, the commitment, the urgency, the surrender, and the receptivity of Bahia. We really do need to see this teaching that the Buddha gives to Bahia in the context in which it's given. Without fully appreciating the context, we can badly misunderstand what this teaching really is. And if we misunderstand it, we turn it into something bland and banal, or even worse, we get into an alienated state or an inflated state. So let's just try to see what this pith teaching of the Buddha is getting at. He tells Bahia to train by practicing just seeing, just hearing, just thinking, just perceiving. It's very interesting in the Pali that, certainly in John Ireland's translation, he puts the words in quote, in the seen, there must be only the seen. And I've looked up the Pali. It's much more an imperative. It's not just in the seen, only the seen. It's there must be only the seen. It's much stronger. But it's as if this is almost like a teaching that you need to repeat to yourself. So just seeing, just hearing, just thinking, just perceiving. The Pali words here are ditta, seeing, sutta, hearing, mutta, which you could translate as thinking, and vinyata, which means perceiving, what you're conscious of. And these four denote the whole range, meant to indicate here, the whole range of cognitional faculties. to all of the senses and the mind. And the practice is to simply experience without adding to what is being experienced. We don't add any ideas, any views, any concepts, any cravings, any aversions, whatever. We don't add anything to what is directly experienced. It's pure mindfulness, pure awareness, if you like. You add nothing at all to the flow of experience. You don't posit any fixed self, for example, behind or within the flow. You don't proliferate in any way. There is just pure, bright, fresh, continuous mindfulness and awareness. So let's just listen to how Bhante reads this teaching. And it's interesting to see that, you know, some of it, he's one of the terms he doesn't, he thinks is a bit obscure. And actually, when you look up even the commentators, not quite sure what it means. The teaching that the Buddha gives is just pure mindfulness. Just be aware. If you see something, just see. Don't read anything into it. Don't project anything onto it. Just see what is there. In the same way, just hear, just think, just perceive. If you do this, there will be no thereby. In other words, there won't be any mental activity explaining anything. You're just remaining with what is actually present here and now. So there are no sanskaras being set up, no karmic consequences. And if there is no mental activity and no karmic consequences, there won't be any therein. Bhante's not sure what that means, but I take it to mean that you have no sense of an in here, a self here, and another there. Those notions are all mental proliferation, all ideas added to experience. Back to Bhante again. If you get rid of the idea of therein, there's no here. There's no there. These are all conceptual distinctions. And there's no in between. So there's no fixing of yourself anywhere. So when all conceptual activity whatsoever stops, then you're in enlightenment. In other words, what the Buddha is saying is that the way to enlightenment is just the present experience, without any interpretation, conceptual judgment, or evaluation. It sounds very easy, but it's obviously very difficult. You've just got experience as it is at this very moment. This is pure mindfulness, or mindfulness only. There is, of course, a great possibility of misunderstanding. The misunderstanding is that you develop alienated awareness, just looking at everything, as it were, from the outside, but not experiencing at the same time. It's probably better to think of it in terms of the mirror-like wisdom, which is on the level of Buddhahood, which just reflects everything. But you have to be like a mirror that doesn't reflect without feeling. The mirror suggests something cold and hard, but you reflect and you feel, you experience, you participate. You listen, for example, and you just hear the wind blowing. And you just stay with that. You don't start thinking it's windy. It might rain later on. It would be a pity if it rained. That would be really bad. I'd be really angry if it rained a bit later. I won't be able to go out. That's all the mind. You're not staying with the sound of the wind. You can even think, because we have the phrase in the thought, only the thought. If thought is needed, then okay. Fair enough. Think. If something has to be done, think how to do it, but go straight from A to B, not sort of wander a long, long way. So that's a little bit of Bhante trying to open up that teaching and pointing out the dangers of it. Earlier on, I related Bahia's story to our private ordination ceremony. I mentioned that Bahia's vision of the Buddha is like the taking up of meditation on the Buddha or some other form at the time of ordination. And when you meditate on the Buddha or a form of the Buddha, in that practice, you develop very strong faith and devotion. In a sense, you sort of feel yourself moving closer to the Buddha, become very absorbed in the vision of the Buddha and the direct sense of the Buddha's qualities. You might even have a sort of experience of being blessed by the Buddha. But at the end of a practice like that, you're encouraged to let it all go. You're encouraged to just sit. To just sit, as it were, with all the richness generated. But you're not sort of doing anything with that richness. You're not being attached to it, but you're not forcing it away either. As Bhante said to me, you're remaining without trying to remain, in a state of enjoying the fruits of the practice. And it's in that rich and full space that in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard, and so on, really comes alive. Sometimes you can experience something like this at the end of the puja. You've done all that devotion, all that chanting, there's been that dwelling on all that beauty, all that darshan of the Buddhas, and so on. You have those wonderful mantras and those three deep shantis, you know, in the dark, chanting those shantis, which are said to symbolize the pacification of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the shantis fade away into silence. And there is just a rich, deep, and full awareness. Sometimes you can even, just for a moment, you have a sense of, well, a sort of nonsense of not being anywhere. You're neither here nor there or in between the two. You can have a sort of little intuition of that. That's why it's so important when those bells go at the end of the puja that there is absolute silence, complete stillness for as long as possible. One older member told me that Sangharakshita once said, you shouldn't move for 2 hours after a puja. I don't know if anybody's tried that. You know, in other words, he's saying it's so deep what has gone on, but you're dwelling in that sort of formless state, I suppose, to call it that. But it comes out of all that practice of devotion that goes before, all that richness, all that dwelling on enlightenment, imagining of enlightenment. So this profound teaching to Bhatia only makes sense for us, only makes sense to me, when we are thoroughly soaked in our other spiritual practices, when we have real devotion and real spiritual friendships, when we have a real sense of service and surrender to the Dharma. So Bhatia was liberated just hearing this teaching of pure mindfulness. But very soon after that, Bhatia was killed. Killed by a cow protecting her calf. Somehow, presumably, he'd got too close to a calf. And apparently at that time, those times, cows can be very, very aggressive. And he was gored, killed, knocked over. And it's as if, of course, Bhatia had a kind of intimation of his mortality. That's why he so urgently wanted, so urgently needed the Dhamma. And when the Buddha found out what had happened to Bhatia, he told his disciples to carry Bhatia's body on a litter and then cremate it and then make a stupa for the remains, the sarira, as they're called, the relics. And the Buddha explained that they needed to do this because your companion in the holy life has died. Your brother in the holy life has died. This is really extraordinary. Bhatia's encounter with the Buddha was so very short. They knew no details about one another. They didn't do a reporting in before the teaching. And the rest of the Buddha's disciples didn't know who this guy was. They would have just looked on at this dramatic encounter the Buddha had with this foreigner wearing a strange robe. But the Buddha tells them, this man is a companion. He's a friend. He's a brother. And his remains need to be treated with care and reverence. And I hear a real tenderness here. And we need to keep that in mind when we consider the pure mindfulness teaching that the Buddha taught Bahya. So often I've come across people into pure awareness, and it all seems to be a trick to avoid real feeling, real participation and engagement with life and other people. Even a sort of callous indifference develops. There's no friendship, no reverence, no love, no faith, no values. But the Buddha, who is the very embodiment of pure mindfulness, treats Bahia's dead body and remains with respect, and wants his other disciples to know the quality of this man, this Bahia. He's a brother in the Dhamma. And in fact, the disciples want to know what has happened to Bahia. What is his destiny? Where is he reborn? What state is he in? They often ask this after somebody who's died. And the Buddha replies, Bahya of the bark cloth was a wise man. He practiced according to the Dhamma, and he did not trouble me by disputing about the Dhamma. Bahya has attained final nirvana. This is an incredible story. It shows us what can be achieved, what can be attained quickly, speedily, directly. People often want a quick way to wisdom, a quick way to enlightenment, a quick way to ordination, and it can be quick. This sutta tells us what is needed. So, 7 points for speed. Well, for a start, Bahya is a renunciate. He's living the spiritual life on the seashore. He's a serious searcher. That's his background. But then, first major point. First of all, we need an honest appraisal of where we actually are. Bahya doesn't argue with the Deva when he tells him he's not an arahant and he's not on the path. So we need to be very honest with ourselves. Where are we actually at, and what do we need to do? Two, we need to be profoundly stirred and thrilled at the slightest encounter with the ideal, with the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. Bahya is stirred and thrilled and humbled at just hearing of the Buddha. Three, we need single-minded commitment and determination to gain the teaching. Bahya walks thousands of miles, well, over 1,000 miles, stopping just for a night, so each night, for the teaching, and gives up all his comfort on the seashore. Four, we need to have intense faith and devotion to the Buddha through seeing the great spiritual beauty of the Buddha. Five, we need a keen awareness of impermanence and the shortness of life and how precious this life is. Six, we need a keen, alert, completely open receptivity to the teacher. We need to be open to whatever he might say or do. Then, quick spiritual progress is possible. Wisdom, enlightenment, ordination. None of those will happen if we go around thinking how great we are already. Finally, there is the Buddha's Udana, the verse uttered out of tremendous inspiration. And we can well imagine how profoundly moved and inspired the Buddha was at Bahya's response to him and Bahya's attainment. You will notice that the verse is a set of negations. And what we have to do when we hear these negations, we have to imagine and intuit the vast realm of Buddhahood that the Buddha is evoking. This is a different translation, and again, I have rendered Brahmin as shaman. There is also another name for the enlightened man here, and that is Muni. Ireland translates this as sage. Muni literally means a silent one, as well as a sage, a wise man. I've left the term Muni untranslated. Where water, earth, fire, air, no footing find, there shine no stars, no sun is there displayed. There gleams no moon, no darkness there is seen. So when the Muni, the shaman, has come to know this through his own wisdom, from form and formless, from pain and pleasure, he is liberated.